Good afternoon. We'll call this meeting to order of the Job Growth and Energy Affordability Policy and Finance Committee. Today is Monday, January 12th. The first thing we're going to do is we're going to start with brief introductions of members of the committee. We have some new members and some older members here, so we'll go ahead and why don't we start with Representative Isaacson, and we'll work our way around the table and have members and staff introduce themselves.
Hi, Jason Isaacson, 42B, Roseville, Little Canada, Badness Heights, Shoreview.
Good morning, Jim Neuberger, 15B, the Becker area.
Good afternoon, Dan Fabian, District 1A, Roseville, Kitson, Marshall, part of Pennington, eastern North Dakota and southern Manitoba.
I'm Anita Newman from House Research.
I'm Harriet Hendricks from Fiscal Analysis Department.
Bill Glahn, GOP Research.
I'm Pat Grofflow. I represent the city of Farmington as well as portions of rural Dakota and Goodhue counties.
Hi, Harry Kennedy. I'm the committee administrator.
Jonathan Fortner, committee legislative assistant.
I'm Ben Weeks from House Research.
Good morning. I'm Dave Baker, freshman from the Candiaway County area out in western Minnesota.
Jason Metza, the east side of the Iron Range.
Chris Wazinski, House District 16A, Marshall, Minnesota.
Bob Lunan, representing Shakopee.
Sheldon Johnson, I represent Southeast St. Paul.
Bob Vogel, 20A. I live in Elko Newmarket and represent Southern Scott and Western Lee Sore counties.
Marion O'Neill, I have 29B, which is Buffalo, Monticello, Maple Lake, and the surrounding townships.
I'm David Sullivan with House DFL Research.
Bob Eliff with House Research.
Dennis Smith, District 34B, Maple Grove.
Eric Simonson, 7B, west side of Duluth.
I'm Mary Mullen. I'm from House Research.
I think we have some staff that may be in the audience. We have our committee page. If I could have the committee page come up and introduce himself and just present us an idea of what he sees happening this legislative session and what his agendas are.
My name is Simon Wenzel. I was at Page in the last session, and I'm ready to be back, and it should be a fun time.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee, everyone. I'm looking forward to the opportunity to serve with you and do some good stuff these next 2 years. I see Representative Lagenius, if you came in, you wanted to introduce yourself and where you're from?
Well, I was a late addition to the committee, so it's probably appropriate that I'm lately introducing myself as Jean Wagenius from Minneapolis and Richfield.
Thank you very much. All right, members, we actually do have a House file on the agenda for today. Representative Davids, you want to come forward, House File 27. The chair will move House File 27 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Taxes. Representative Davids, you have the floor, and feel free to give a presentation and call on the those who you feel would be most able to attend. Mr. Michael is here. Well, we're starting off with the A-team. Wow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If a page could distribute this letter, please. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What I'd like to, and thank you for hearing this bill on very short notice, and I would like to explain to the committee what the plan is on how this all fits. I'll be carrying the tax conformity bill tomorrow in the tax committee. It'd be my intention, if this bill passes through this committee, to amend it on to that tax bill, the tax conformity bill. You should have before you a letter from the City of Rochester to Senator Scoy and myself describing their support for House File 27. As you know, Mr. Chairman, House File 27 was passed, the DMC legislation was passed 2 years ago in the Omnibus Tax Bill. If you recall, the Omnibus Tax Bill went out with no Republican support, but of course the Omnibus Tax Bill was much, much more than the DMC legislation. And before I get started, I'd also like to introduce Senator Nelson here is with us, who could answer questions if necessary. And we have several other folks that will be available for questioning of the committee. There were several issues in the DMC bill that the Attorney General wrote an opinion on that disagreed with what our legislative intent clearly was. What House File 27 does is it brings us back in time to clarify two provisions that we'll visit about today. I have with me a representative of, are you DMC or UMA or what are you?
DMCC.
DMCC. And, of course, Joel Michael from House Research. There's about four issues this session that we'll be looking at that need to be corrected for the DMC, Destination Medical Center. The two you have before you today are clarifying, I think, an incorrect Attorney General's opinion. The first issue having to do with when DMC would qualify for funding. Clearly, the legislative intent was that it would be figured on a cumulative basis. In other words, whatever they did the first year, if they didn't hit the thresholds, they could carry that forward to the next year. It was very clear. If you look at legislative intent, if you look at every document, every financial page, everything we did showed that it was cumulative. So how the Attorney General came up with that opinion, I can't answer that. I think it's incorrect. That's the one point. So that it's cumulative instead of per year. If it was left, as the Attorney General is saying, one could argue that DMC would never qualify, or it would take billions and billions of dollars to qualify. Point number two, as far as clarification, is having to do with the local match for general state aid. So it adds a reference to the development plan in the local match requirement to make it clear that the city payments for preparation of the development plan qualify towards the local match. That was very clear in the legislation passed 2 years ago. The Attorney General was questioning that, and so that's the other thing we clear up. So whether you support DMC or you do not support DMC, that's not the issue today. The issue today is to clear this up so that DMC can move forward as the legislature intended 2 years ago. So that's what House File 27 does, and of course, before we get into some other testimony, Mr. Chairman, it'd be my intention to put this on to the Tax Conformity Bill, House File 6, tomorrow, and then move it forward. And tax conformity is, of course, a very important issue that some of you that are members of the Tax Committee will see tomorrow, but I would ask for your support to pass House File 27 clarifying language to get us back to where the legislature intends. So we've got kind of a separation of powers issue here. We have the executive branch, the Attorney General's office saying that it wasn't clear. We're saying it's clear, but you know what? She's the Attorney General. Let's clear it up for her so she can clearly read what the legislative intent is. With that, I'd like to turn to Joel Michael for some explanation as to why he believes, and I think that the question is to the validity of the Attorney General's opinion. Myself,
I think someone's tractor beam is apparently on. So if members are on the table, if you could please put your phone into airplane mode.
So again, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before we go to Mr. Michael, again, I just want to reiterate that this is not a vote for the DMC. Now, there's not one member on my side of the aisle that voted for it, not one. Had it been a standalone bill, would I have voted for it? Yes, I would have. It's a very important project. It's very important for the entire state of Minnesota. And so I just never received a chance to do that. But that being said, this is not, I don't like DMC, let's nail them. That's not what this is about. This is about clarifying for the Attorney General what the clear legislative intent was. And if Mr. Michael or Ms. Lam could, you know, if I'm describing anything incorrectly here, please let's get it on the record. That's why we're having the hearing. If I be gentle, if you would. But if I've described anything that's not completely accurate, please state that for the record.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Joel Michael from House Research.
Kathleen Lamb on behalf of the Destination Medical Center Corporation and EDA.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, just to sort of reiterate what Chair David said, that this legislation really has two key components. The first provision is that it clarifies that amounts that are spent to prepare the development plan qualifies as a project cost, and so therefore can be paid for by the city and qualify for the local match with it, or use state aid to pay for those costs. The second part goes to the question about how the aid is to be calculated, and the chair of the tax committee, correctly stated what the bill does, which is to say, rather than being an annual calculation, this will be calculated on a cumulative amount. So each year, the Commissioner of Trade and Economic, of the Department of Trade and Economic Development, will look at the total expenditures, the total private expenditures that have been made in Rochester in the qualifying area, subtract the $200 million threshold amount, and then determine how much aid that would yield. As to the issue of the Attorney General's opinion, the Attorney General looked at the language and concluded that it was ambiguous, and based on a fair number of considerations, concluded that it was best to read the language that it would be an annual calculation. I will say that having worked with the legislators who were involved, that was not the intent. The intent was to have it be a cumulative calculation. And in fact, the language that most of us thought resulted in a cumulative calculation, if you look at the bill on page 3, lines 27 and 28, you will see that it's striking two words, the sum of, and that is the language that most of us thought yielded a cumulative calculation. What we're doing now is changing the definition to make it clear that the definition is a cumulative calculation. The Attorney General focused on the definition, which was an annual amount, and then those annual amounts were to be summed to get the cumulative calculation. The Attorney General focused on the definition and concluded it was just an annual amount, not a cumulative amount. So what the legislation does is to change the definition and say that it will be defined as a cumulative amount, and so it'll be very clear that it's to be calculated that way. Now, I will say that the fiscal note that was prepared by the Minnesota Management and Budget was prepared on the assumption that it was a cumulative amount. That's what our fiscal analysts understood. So I honestly was a little bit mystified when the Attorney General came out with the opinion, but again, it's the kind of thing, if you focus on the definition, I can see how the Attorney General got to where she got. But that's, as the chair said, was not consistent with the legislators who were working on this legislation back in 2013. And there's also a practical reason for that. If the amount can fluctuate annually, you can imagine if there's, for example, a repeat of the Great Recession and real estate development in Rochester stalls or stops totally for several years. If you use an annual amount, suddenly that aid would stop totally. And what the city's planning to do is to issue long-term debt that will be paid back with this aid payment plus their local taxes. And if the aid stopped, the city would be in an untenable position because it would be unable to really pay that debt. And that's the policy reason why it always was assumed that it would be a cumulative calculation and not an annual amount. So I don't know if that helps clarify, Mr. Chair, the...
Any additional comments at all before we remember
questions? Sure, that helped a lot.
Good. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and nice to see Mr. Michaels here. I'll just remind you that DTED's been gone 10 years. It's now DEED. But my real question is, with this cumulative effect, how much investment, both by the city, Mayo, and then private investment, has to be reached before the full $127 million of state, I believe it's $127 million of the state piece, is is reached.
Representative Mahoney, is that for a specific testifier or just open?
Well, I'm gonna just claim one of those is the smarter than me, so they can answer it.
Well, I can't answer it then.
Yeah, we know.
Mr. Chair,
I don't have anything in front of Tax Committee this year.
Mr. Chair, Representative.
And if you could please state your name just for the record.
Kathleen Lamb, on behalf of the Destination Medical Center Corporation and EDA. If I could maybe review just the numbers for a minute first. Before any state aid flows at all, there has to be, the deed has to certify that there has been $200 million of private investment. That has not occurred yet, and so no state money has started to flow yet. What happened in 2013 was a market study was performed that indicated that if there were this much infrastructure, public infrastructure done, it could leverage this amount of private investment. So the numbers are that the state and the city together, that number is $585 million. Of that, the city has $128 million it must invest over that 20-year period, and the state's commitment is $455 million over the 20-year period. The thought is that that amount will then generate $3.5 billion of investment from Mayo and an additional one point something to get to 5.6 approximately billion of private investment. So that's kind of the overall that's the overall look at the numbers. And that was based, as I said, on a market study that was done before the legislation was brought forward in 2013. There has not been anything that changes that forecast of what the public infrastructure will leverage in terms of the private investment. So the development plan that is being, it's online right now and it's being, it's been published for public comment, indicates that over the life of this, 20-year life of this project, that those are the numbers that can be achieved.
Representative Mahoney, any follow-up?
Yes. So, in Mr. Chair, Ms. Lamb, I stand corrected. $400 million, north of $400 million, is the state piece. What's the minimum investment by all entities except the state? At what point will the 400 and I think you said 27 million?
Mr. Chair, for the state investment?
Yes.
455.
455.
Representative Mahoney.
At what point does that run out? I mean, is it at the 3.5 billion or is it at the 5.4 billion or 6 billion? What's the dollar figure of private and Mayo investment that has to be invested before $455 million of state money is done and we're not on the hook anymore?
Ms. Lim.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, this is a 20-year plan, and so annually DEED has to look at how much has been invested by private entities before it releases any amount of state money.
Yeah.
So over the 20-year life of this, there, I suppose, could be ebbs and flows of private investment. But the thought is that the plan actually is that with this amount of public investment over the 20 years, because it's going to take a while to do this, the private investment will come along kind of proportionately. And so at the end of the 20 years, there is this $5.6 billion of private investment.
Representative Mahoney, any follow-up?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Ms. Lamb, all I'm asking is, does the $454 million is all used up by year 19 and you get to $5.5 billion? I mean, I'm just trying to figure out what's the total investment that you have to make that uses up the $455 million. I mean, is it, and I don't care whether it's in year 1 or year 19 or year 20, what I want to know is, when is the state when is the $455 million projected to be totally used? Is it, and at what dollar figures? Because if you cumulatively add stuff together, first year, second year, third year is $200 million. The fifth year could be $2 billion. Mm-hmm. You know, and this is a 20-year plan, so if you get the $5.6 billion in the eighth year, and you've used up, would you have used up the $455 million? And that's all. I'm trying to figure this out so I know how long out we're on the hook.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I can answer that question because the development plan itself has the schedules in it with respect to how much per phase every 5 years they expect the market will contribute with respect to this private investment. So I'm not sure that I can answer your question other than to say that the 455 is scheduled over the entire 20 years.
Ms. Templin, do you want to add some additional information for the committee?
Mr. Chair, Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal Staff. I can try. You received a fiscal note on this bill, House File 27. And if you look on page 3 of that fiscal note, there is a header that says long-term fiscal considerations. And I think that kind of sort of gets at what Representative Mahoney's question is. This description in the long-term considerations is that the state aid could be paid out under this cumulative formula as early as fiscal 27. And I think Deed could speak to this, but I think they modeled this, the state aid, and how much could be paid out in terms of the maximum cap. And they projected that in order to make that projection, they have to incorporate the private investment assumptions. And those assumptions were published in November 2014. And I have been kind of modeling the same estimate, and I get that $3.1 billion in private investment would be needed to get to the state aid cap in 2027. But I think Deed could also speak to that.
And Mr. Michael, just to be clear, the intent of the authors of this of House File 27 is to have this be as it was presented to the conference committee members in the legislature last session and signed into law. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, if you're asking me, I think the answer is correct. It's to reflect the legislative intent of the original bill.
And Mr. Michael, you said the fiscal notes in the previous session reflected this intent?
Mr. Chair, that's my understanding.
Mr. Chair, since the bill was passed in 2013, the private investment assumptions have changed and have been modified. And that is a significant difference since 2013.
Thank you. This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, Senator Nelson, I see you're here. Did you want to offer any words, or you just want to give us the thumbs up on this? Or the thumbs down, I suppose you could.
No, this is a thumbs up, Mr. Chair. Carla Nelson, Senator Nelson, just wanted to thank the committee for its prompt action. We know that uncertainty freezes investments, and so I think clarifying the legislative intent and just in a Rep. David's bill here in a speedy manner is the way the project can continue on pace. So thank you for your consideration.
Compliment from the Senate doesn't get much better than that, does it? With that, we'll close the public comment portion of our meeting and go to members' questions or comments. Any questions or comments from members of the committee? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to verify and get on the record that in the long run, this is not going to affect in any way then the state portion, the money that we're going to be putting forth in any way, shape, or form.
Ms. Lamb.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the state portion does not change. What changes per the fiscal note is that it may be slightly accelerated into the next biennium, but the overall number does not change.
Any additional comments or questions from members? Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one. Representative, or Mr. Chair Davids, quick one for you. Is it just the $16 million over the course of time that this costs in total extra to the state?
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative. That's not an additional cost. That's a cost. Once the Attorney General gave the opinion, then when the numbers were done, it put it off a little bit further. We're bringing it forward just a little bit to fiscal 17. So there's no more cost. It's just there would be $16 million in 17 instead of a later date, which could have been somewhat later because it was. And also, I'd like to thank you for that question. I'd also like to, Mr. Chairman, state that from what I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong here, that both chairs at the time, Chair Lincheski and Chair Skoy, wrote letters to the Attorney General saying, no, we really meant it this way. I believe it, sometimes as chairs, when there's a question of legislative intent, we'll write a letter saying, no, we really meant it this way. And I believe that was done in this case with the authors of the bill. Right. So it would have been Representative Norton and who? And Senator Skoy.
Senator Sendrum.
So those letters were written. The legislative intent is clear. If some of you are looking for a fun time with DMC, as I've told some folks, in school from time to time, my teacher would say, Gregory, today is not the day. That happened from time to time. So if you want to get a DMC, today is not the day. This is simply clarifying what the legislative intent was. We've got a separation of power issue here. There will be a day, I will guarantee it, where there is some actual policy change. What Senator Skoy and I did agree to was that we're bringing clarification language, we're not bringing any policy changes. Those days we'll look forward to with bated breath in the future.
With that promise, Representative Davids, the chair renews his motion to have House File 27 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. The motion passes. Thank you, Representative
Davids. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Members, since we've convened, we've had a couple of other members who have come in, and I just want to give them an opportunity to briefly introduce themselves. So if we can start with, I think, Representative Hortman. And I think
Peggy Scott, I represent Andover, Northern Coon Rapids, and a precinct in Ramsey.
Me? Representative Tim Mahoney, I represent the northeast corner of the city of St. Paul.
Is there anyone else I missed who came in? Okay, good. Just a couple of announcements for the committee. First of all, for members, with regards to attendance, it's assumed that you are excused. If for some reason you're not able to be in committee, there's no reason to notify the committee legislative assistant, all members who are absent. If you've got something more important to go on, we're assuming that's why you're not here, so you'll be noted as excused. Also, this committee has a significantly large portfolio of issues, so going forward, just be aware this is a committee that will start on time, and there's a high likelihood that we're going to have some nighttime committee hearings. Other than that, I just look forward to working with everyone, and I'm thankful for this opportunity. It's a great committee. We've got basically an all-star committee of members from both the majority and minority parties, a lot of experience and talent, and I'm looking forward to doing some good stuff with you the next 2 years. The first item on our agenda here is the Citizens League here? There they are. So we'll let you guys set up, and we'll just kind of could please briefly introduce yourself and tell everybody what it is you're doing here, because they have no idea.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Pahua Hoffman. I'm the policy director at the Citizens League. We're excited to support the work of this committee as you all look for ways to create jobs in and set new energy policy for Minnesota. For those who are not familiar with the Citizens League, we are a nonpartisan, multi-issue organization that provides opportunities where Minnesotans, both subject matter experts and lay citizens, can learn from one another to find common ground in order to develop and advance policy. Sorry about that. Related to energy, several years ago, the League was approached by policymakers, both inside and outside of the energy realm, to examine the future of Minnesota's electrical energy system. We took questions such as what's working, what's not working, what do we want to keep, how do we modernize? What we learned through this work is that the energy system is complicated and discussions can get highly technical. We hope today's presentation will get us thinking about our values and our priorities, which I think we can all agree is fundamental to our decision-making when it comes to setting policies around affordable, reliable, clean, and efficient energy. At this time, I'd like to introduce my colleague, Adam Arling, who is our staff lead on our electrical energy project.
Welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Again, my name is Adam Arling. I'm project coordinator with our electrical energy project. And today, rather than listing off some of the facts and statistics about our energy system and to get us thinking about this, we're going to have a little bit more fun. So, surprise, a little pop quiz. And so my colleague here is going to be passing out some clickers. We're going to have a little bit of fun looking at some of the facts and statistics and rankings about Minnesota and how we compare to other states when it comes to some energy issues. So have no fear, this is anonymous. None of this will be associated with you. And it's not meant to be a gotcha moment. It's more to see where we're at as a baseline for starting the legislative session. So we will, in addition, after some of the questions, show some charts and data. We're not going to dwell too much on this, just because I know there's a lot more on the agenda, and there are many more experts you'll hear from over the course of the year. But this is just to get us start to thinking about some of these issues. So I'm going to start off with a couple softball questions and see what is your favorite sports team. Can everyone see these on the screen, too? Great. So the polling's open, and we'll ask that you select one, two, three, or four, depending on your answer. The clicker will record your last response. So if you think the Timberwolves, but you accidentally click the Twins, it's all right. And you should get a green light. So if you don't get a green light, let us know. We'll pass you out a new clicker. And we'll just start. Yeah, you should be able to see. There we go.
And I'm not able to see the number of responses. Can you tell me?
I can see up 20 right now. So I think we have about 26, 27.
Okay, well, I'm not going to fill it up. So.
All right. And these answers were a little bit biased to Minnesota, I'll admit. But one more softball question. In your opinion, how do you believe Minnesota is performing when it comes to dealing with issues of affordability, reliability, and reducing emissions from energy production sources? Would you say we're doing excellent, good, average, or poor?
And for members of the committee, again, this is anonymous. There's no tracking going on. This is
exactly.
So Representative Scott, no data privacy concerns, I promise.
All right, but 3 seconds.
Can you believe the micro gig?
All right. So that's where folks think we're at. All right. Now to some other questions where there's some right and wrong answers, but we'll see where people are at on these. So according to the United States Energy Information Administration, and I'll be referring to their data quite a bit just by EIA, in 2014, where did Minnesota rank nationally in average retail price of electricity in all sectors? So this isn't just residential or industrial. This is the whole lot of it. Are we third? 14th, 26th, or 48th? And so first would be the most affordable, and 50th would be least affordable. Okay. All right. So it looks like 60% of folks thought we were the 26th state, and that is correct. It's actually up from 30th in 2012. And so just a little slice of the data here. You can see all sectors here. Minnesota's in blue. We're slightly below the United States average, and actually across each sector. And I'll be passing out copies of these slide decks after the fact, too, if anyone wants to look at these answers. I'm not going to give them out beforehand. Great. So number four here. In 2014, what was the most expensive state for residential electricity? Was it California, Massachusetts, Connecticut, or Hawaii? All right, looks like we have everyone in. Okay, most folks say Hawaii, followed up by California with 35%. The actual answer is Hawaii, and that's as a result of them being so isolated and needing, in part, due to needing to import a lot of coal and petroleum. But just to look at the breakdown, they're quite an outlier when it comes to electricity prices, too. For residential electricity, this is just broken down by that. So on the flip side, let's look at which state had the most affordable residential electricity in 2014. Again, this is according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration. Was it Washington, North Dakota, Texas, or Alaska? All right, looks like we have everyone. Okay. Most people think it's North Dakota. 5% think it's the correct answer of actually Washington here, and that's in large part due to the production of hydroelectric energy in the state. About two-thirds of their energy comes from that source. And just a breakdown of the cost, whereas Hawaii was at about 38 cents per kilowatt hour, Washington's at about 9 cents, so quite a big spread. And just another way to look at it here, this is again just for residential energy, electricity. You can see Hawaii at the top there, the most expensive, Washington at the bottom. We're missing the middle section, but Minnesota is 18th when it comes to residential electricity. You can see there's quite a spread, but quite a few states in the middle there that are missing between about 14 to 11 cents, and Minnesota's right nestled in there. So, just another way of looking at it, you can notice that the most expensive states are Alaska, Hawaii, California, and a lot of the Northeast. And then Minnesota is with most of the rest of the country in that 10 to 13 cents per kilowatt hour zone. Comparison to our Midwestern counterparts, Minnesota is in the middle there when it comes to commercial and industrial prices. Again, this is cents per kilowatt hour, but if you're looking at how we compare to our neighbors in the region. So number six, according to the Department of Commerce, Division of Energy Resources, in 2013, what was the lowest cost energy resource for Minnesota? Something that ought to be pursued. Was it solar, coal, wind, natural gas, or energy efficiency and conservation programs? All right. We'll give you 10 more seconds.
Are people abstaining?
We're going to lose some more? All right, we'll cut it off there. 42% say coal, followed by natural gas, and then energy efficiency conservation program. So it's actually number five there, and it sounds like sort of a trick question. You don't often think of energy efficiency programs as an energy resource. In fact, it is. And there's also some national advocacy groups who have made some comparisons to other resources and seeing that energy efficiency programs and ones like our conservation improvement program are actually giving us about a kilowatt hour for I think it's about 3 cents on average, compared to two or three times that for some of these other energy resources. So just a few more questions. According to the EIA in 2014, what was the largest source of electricity generation in Minnesota? Did most of our electricity come from coal, nuclear, natural gas, hydroelectric, or was it some combination of wind and solar? 5 seconds. All right. So most people got this one here, and it is coal. It accounts for about 43.5%. This was in 2014. And so as a follow-up to that, in 2012, so we're going back a couple of years due to data collection, which of the following most accurately reflects our mix of electricity generation? So from greatest to least, we know coal's first around 43%, but what comes next in order from greatest to least? Seconds. All right. Okay. So most people think it's coal, followed by natural gas, nuclear, wind, and then other energy sources, followed by number one there, with nuclear in second rather than natural gas. And number one is actually the correct answer. On the next slide, we'll see the actual composition of 2012. about 44% coal, 23 actually nuclear. So that's in second, coming from those the two plants near Minneapolis-St. Paul, the Monticello reactor in Prairie Island 1 and 2. Natural gas and wind, and actually in 2013, Minnesota was seventh in net energy generation from wind energy, and then followed by some others. So it should be noted, solar's not included in this. There was no data collected by the EIA during 2012 for this, so that's not included. All right, so now according to the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, in 2012, what was the average capacity factor for utility-scale generation from photovoltaics in Minnesota? It's about 50%, 18%, 45%, or 12%. So the capacity factor here is a measure of how, how efficient this energy source is, how long it can be running during the day over a specific period of time. So would it be... Oh, I'm sorry. We did not have a timer on that one. But we didn't have everyone respond. So that's all right. So the actual answer is 18%. And you can see the breakdown by state here. You can see Minnesota. This isn't in order, but it is by state. They range from about 16 to 27% or so, and Minnesota is around 18, 19%. And just another comparison based on some other renewables, just the variability of over a year, the capacity factor for solar photovoltaic there in light green. All right, final question. So in 2011, Minnesota ranked what nationally in total CO2 emissions? So this is CO2 emissions total, not per capita. So when you compare us to other states, where did we rank? Number one would be most CO2 emissions, and 50th would be the least. All right. See, most people, it's a pretty close between 23rd and 32nd, and the correct answer is actually 23rd. You can't see that over the green. Just a couple of ways of slicing the data. This is by state. You see Minnesota in the middle there. Texas is actually pretty, quite high. And they factor these numbers based on energy generation, and that's where a lot of the CO2 emissions come from, about 80%. So you can see Texas is quite high up there. If you look at it per capita, Minnesota is still in about the middle of the pack, with Wyoming at the top because they have they're also at the top for electricity generation, but as you know, their population is quite a bit less than Texas, so it skews the results in that direction, but Minnesota is still nestled in the middle there. So, looks like we don't have all the participant leaders, but that's all right. So this is just a way to establish baseline, know kind of a little bit about some of the energy issues and rankings of Minnesota. We'll pass out some of the slides, but the Citizens League has, as my colleague had mentioned, been in this space for a few years. We've been convening stakeholders around some electrical energy work. And we have this video that I'm not going to show today, but we encourage you to look at online. We partnered with Twin Cities Public Television, David Gillette over there, to produce this illustrated essay to talk about some of the issues related to the energy system that were in our recent report as of last year. So I want to thank you all for your time today. Please reach out to us if you have any questions, and we really appreciate your time.
We'll stand for questions if there are any, Mr. Chair and members.
Well, I just wanted to say thank you for putting that together, and the purpose of this was not to skew the committee one way or another. It's just to reinforce the fact that particularly energy policy is a very complex area of public policy, and one of our responsibilities as legislators is to do our best to educate the public and help make sure they have the facts and the public policy decisions they make. And obviously, the first knowledge base and knowledge learning starts with us. So I just want to thank you again to the Citizens League for doing this. We appreciate it. So
thank you.
Turn your clickers into you, or yes. Just pass them down to... All right, next on our agenda is we have just a very brief overview of the three different types of utilities in Minnesota. So Mr. Black, if you want to go first, or Mr. Evans or Mr. Johnson, I don't, as long as you guys just figure it out. And again, members, this is not to do a deep dive on it, it's just really to categorize those three different types of utilities in Minnesota by a very cursory and brief overview. So, Mr. Evans, are you going to be starting? Mr. Blatwick?
Mr. Chair, actually, I was told that I could go first.
That's absolutely. Welcome to the committee.
I never get to go first, but I got a chance this time.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bill Black, Government Relations Director with Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association, and I am here with the Government Relations Representative, her first day on the job, Amanda Dewar. I've got a PowerPoint presentation that we won't get very far without, so I will try and bring it up here. We didn't get a chance to preload. Let's see. Could also let someone go first if they were ready to, but this doesn't seem to be coming up. Or this isn't plugged in to the. It's not plugged in.
Do the PowerPoint ready to go?
Yep.
Okay. Then we will plug you in. It's one of them on the screen until you're ready to.
Oh, okay. No, I didn't see it.
Only there was an IT person sharing this committee who could help.
Here.
Problems with a Microsoft product. Who would have thought it?
I'll go extra quickly now since I've taken a little extra of your time.
Your 5 minutes is about up. Thank you. No.
Great. Okay, great. All right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having us. These are the 125 municipal electric and 32 municipal gas utilities in the state of Minnesota. 17 cities have both, and of the 87 county seats in Minnesota, 50 of them are served by a municipal electric or gas utility. This presentation focuses mainly on the electrics. Here in Minnesota, municipal utilities tend to be a small-town institution. The largest here by far is Rochester. In fact, Rochester Public Utilities is almost three times the size of the next largest, Moorhead. Almost three-quarters of our municipal utilities, 92 of them, have fewer than 2,500 customers. 40%, that's 48 utilities, have fewer than 1,000 customers. And here are the smallest municipals in the state, with Wayland being the smallest at 39 electric customers. People are surprised to hear that the list of municipal electric utilities in the United States includes Los Angeles, Seattle, Orlando, three state capitals, and other major cities. The average municipal utility is about one-eighth the size of the average co-op in Minnesota. If you look at median size, municipals are about one-fifth as large. Even though there are 170 utilities in the state and 125 of them are municipal, the proportion of the state's retail energy that they provide is just about 14%. Even though there are nationally about 15% of electricity comes from publicly owned utilities, so Minnesota is very typical. You'll sometimes hear public power or publicly owned used interchangeably with municipal utility. It's the same thing, except that some ownership is public, but not strictly speaking municipal. In some states, there is ownership by groups of cities together or regional type public ownership arrangements, such as public utility districts. Public utilities in our statutes refers to investor-owned utilities So that is a common confusing point within our statutes. Public utilities and public power are different, and we hope to make you more familiar with that as we get to know you all, those of you who we don't know well already. 58% of the power sold by municipal utilities comes from municipal power agencies. These municipal power agencies are the public power partners of Minnesota's municipal utilities. Each not-for-profit agency is a membership organization, with the members being municipal utilities. Their boards are made up of representatives from the utilities themselves. MMPA's membership is mostly near the Twin Cities area, but also includes East Grand Forks. That's Minnesota Municipal Power Agency. Southern Municipal Power Agency, SMPA, is made up of these member communities. Not all are in the South, as the name implies, but that's the way the agency has grown since it started in 1977. NMPA's members are in the Northwest. Heartland is called a consumer power district because it is organized that way under South Dakota law and is headquartered just across the border, serving communities in South Dakota, Minnesota, and Iowa. MRES serves communities in western Minnesota as well as in Iowa and South Dakota and North Dakota. Again, here's the chart showing where our power comes from. In the background, you can see the Faribault Energy Center, owned by a Minnesota Municipal Power Agency. It is a plant of the combined cycle gas turbine variety that produces 300 megawatts of electricity for the agency's member communities. This is the newest large plant owned by a municipal power agency serving Minnesota. Much of our baseload energy comes from coal, in part because coal is an accessible domestic fuel with a stable price, and existing plants are being paid for over their licensed useful lifetimes. The blue slice of the chart says that WAPA represents power supplied by the federal government and to some of the municipals in Minnesota. That power comes mainly from a series of federal hydropower dams on the Missouri River. Nearly all of the federal power allotments date back to the 1950s and 60s. This hydropower is not considered renewable under Minnesota's renewable energy standard. Only hydropower from much smaller dams may be counted toward the RES. As you can tell here, eligibility for WAPA power allocation was based in part on geographical distance from the Missouri River. All of the power agencies have at least one member that receives federal power. Virtually all of Missouri River energy members in Minnesota do, as well as six utilities that are not affiliated with any power agency. The municipal electric sector met the good faith effort objective of 7% renewable by the end of 2010, as well as the first mandatory standard of 12% by the end of 2012. And we are also on the way to achieving the next benchmark of 17% by 2016. This is one of the large wind farms that supply power to municipal utility communities. SMPA buys all the energy from the 67 turbines at this location, the Wapsipinicon farm south of Rochester. NMPA receives its wind power from the Ashtabula wind farm west of Fargo through Minn Kota Cooperative. Missouri River Energy buys 40 megawatts from the Rugby wind farm north central North Dakota and from turbines in Minnesota, 9 near Marshall, 10 near Odin, and 4 outside of Worthington. Some public wind power comes from small local generation sites. At Anoka and Greece, East Grand Forks, Minnesota's hometown wind power project provides wind. There are 2 in Redwood Falls and 4 in Fairmont, owned by SMPA, 3 in Moorhead, 4 in Worthington, owned by Missouri River Energy, 1 in Mountain Lake, owned by Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency, and 2 in Wilmer, owned by Wilmer Municipal Utilities. Hydropower from plants with less than 100 megawatts qualifies as renewable under the RES. Naturally, municipals were early adopters of small hydro. Here's the municipal hydro plant at Granite Falls. The 4 electric generators in this photo all burn gas from a landfill in Elk River. Other utilities have landfill gas plants too, and others generate power from municipal solid waste. Virginia and Hibbing Municipal Utilities partnered to create the Laurentian Energy Authority, which burns waste wood from lumber operations and will one day burn popular trees from its own wind tree farm. The Wilmer Municipal Utility converted one of its generators into a corn cob to energy plant under an interim permit from the Pollution Control Agency. That's no longer functioning, but was useful in learning more about biomass generation. In Le Sueur, Minnesota Municipal Power Agency's hometown bioenergy facility, generates power from food processing wastes, creating electricity, liquid fertilizer, and solid fuel. There are new federal regulations for diesel generators that require these utilities to spend $40,000 to $100,000 on each to capture more emissions. For some units, this will make economic sense. Others may be retired. It may seem like a good idea to retire some of these older generators, but they have been useful in short runs for emergency backup power, voltage support, and reliability assurance in communities that receive bulk of their power from distant sources. These renewable energy facilities are the Litchfield diesel biodiesel generators. Everyone relies on transmission lines to get their electricity. Very little of the transmission capacity of Minnesota is owned by public power utilities. This makes us particularly vulnerable to charges from power delivery from distant sources. One of the reasons we're such big advocates for moving along the transmission line construction process is that even though our customers will pay for it in the end, it's a better way to pay for building the needed lines than to pay increasing access charges indefinitely as transportation capacity becomes increasingly scarce. Despite what you often hear, municipal utilities are not unregulated. They are locally regulated. We here at the Capitol talk about the Public Utilities Commission as if they were the only Public Utilities Commission. Of course, we mean the state PUC. But there are over 60 local public utility commissions in the state regulating municipal electric utilities. About half of the municipal utilities in Minnesota are governed by a local public utilities commission. The other half are governed directly by their city councils. This picture commemorates retiring Blooming Prairie Commissioner Ronald Anderson in the center of the photo. In other respects, municipal utilities are governed under state statutes, like the investor-owned and cooperative utilities. Every utility in Minnesota is part of the state's conservation improvement program. Every power agency is subject to the renewable energy standard. We're governed by laws that require all utilities to assist low-income customers who can't pay their bills in the winter. By permitting laws and statutes that define where we serve. Our councils and commissions are also subject to open meetings laws, statutes, and the Government Data Practices Act. Municipal utilities make good testing grounds for energy efficiency programs like the ones mentioned here, as well as many others. Municipal utilities here in Minnesota are exceptional in the way they work together to maximize the value and effectiveness of their resources and human expertise. MMUA provides coordinated training and education all over the state, helping municipal utility communities to fill jobs locally. To assist in line worker development, MMUA operates a 20-acre training center in Marshall that emphasizes hands-on technical and skills training in a safe, controlled, and professionally supervised environment. Every year, line workers and supervisors from other municipal utilities come to the aid of communities hit by disaster. These are just a few of the larger disasters of the past few years where the Municipal Mutual Aid Network was called into action under the organization structure set up by MMUA. Generally, electric service is restored in municipal utility communities in surprisingly quick fashion. And I was told to mention that next year, Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association will be hosting the National American Public Power Association's Line Worker Rodeo at Canterbury Downs. And you're all invited April 2nd, 2016, rain or shine or snow. It's going to be a pretty huge event. And if you don't come, you'll hear about it in the news.
We'll hear about it if we don't come. Otherwise, or
you'll see it in person if you
do
come.
Just want to be clear. Thank you.
Chairman, I think you
Representative Mahoney.
You. I think you should go up to one of those JLG lifts.
Yeah. So you can never let me down. I bet. Yeah. Please continue with your presentation, sir.
When cities with municipal electric and gas utilities grow in area, the new residents, schools, businesses, and industries are naturally eligible to receive electric and gas utility service from the city, just as they would water, sewer, and other city services. Coordinating city planning and services with private development helps outstate communities grow wisely. Municipal utilities are not only regulated locally, they are run locally. When a municipal utility customer calls her utility, someone in her own town answers the phone. Public Power Week is recognized annually in the first full week of October in municipal utility communities across the state and nation. And more than 60 cities in Minnesota are served today by a municipal electric utility founded over 100 years ago. Mr. Chair, briefly, that's our presentation and overview, and be happy to answer any questions that we might be able to.
Thank you, Mr. Black. And obviously, this is not going to be the only time you'll be talking to this committee this session. We do appreciate you providing that brief overview to members of the committee, and thanks for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Scott, you had a quick question. My apologies.
I have a quick question. Thank you. Real quick. I noticed the training center in Marshall. Do you coordinate with the community college there in any way? Do they have a program for line workers there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, there is some coordination. I couldn't tell you the level of it at this point. We also provide a range of line worker training programs. It used to be we'd have a sort of a training college, but it's become more popular to have the instructors go to the local communities themselves and actually provide that training on a, more of a one-to-one type of basis.
Thank you.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Black, hi from Daryl Teitbach, by the way. You talked about your standby generators that some utilities have, municipal utilities. How many hours per year would those actually run? Do you have any idea?
Mr. Black.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, the rule that I alluded to was the EPA's RICE rule, reciprocating engine internal combustion engine rule, that limited diesel power generation, but it allows for some to run just enough to keep them prepared for emergency situations. So I believe that 60 hours is the emergency run limit.
Yeah.
If you're going to receive any payment for capacity that you provide to the grid, you are required to install converters that were pretty expensive. And for some utilities, it made economic sense to keep doing that. And some had to retire those units, or they're standing by.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Black, we can get into this later, but I was told in Thief River Falls, for example, that it cost them about $300,000 to upgrade their diesel standby generating system that they used about 60 hours a year. Is that accurate?
Mr. Black.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, I don't know the specifics on that. I know that it was very expensive for some utilities. That wouldn't surprise me.
Representative Simons.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, first of all, I thought it was a really good presentation, but my question is, and maybe I missed the slide, but could you just get an update on munis and their with respect to the Minnesota Solar Standard and where they fall under that?
Mr. Black.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simonson, municipal utilities as well as the cooperatively owned and operated utilities are have their own rate-making bodies locally, and so they are free to explore their generation supply and their rate making locally. So they have actual local control that, like Austin, Texas, Austin, Minnesota, also has the freedom to do, you know, a separate rate for solar, for electric vehicles. And so they respond to their local community as far as what they want to do generation-wise. So they take the input and determine what is the best portfolio mix for the community. And they're moving more toward some just distributed generation from customers. But as a whole, trying to get utility-scale solar, which would be the most cost-effective, is hard for the smaller communities. But we're actually exploring ways to try to get municipals together to partner. We've got a MMUA-sponsored municipal solar task force that's had three meetings, and the next one is next Friday. And we're working on ways to partner to get more solar.
Thank you. Appreciate your presentation to us. Next, we'll go with Mr. Johnson, and then we'll finish up with the IOUs. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Joel Johnson. I represent the Minnesota Rural Electric Association. Thank you for this opportunity. I think all of you were given a PowerPoint in your packets, and I'll just go through that quickly with you. We do have a lot of similarities with the municipal utilities. Bill had mentioned the number of municipal utilities that are over 100 years old. And when we were first building up the electric grid across the country, really in the late 1800s, early 1900s, that essentially skipped rural areas of the country. And in fact, the rural electrification really didn't begin in earnest until the 1930s. Essentially, what had happened was the private investor-owned utilities and the municipal utilities did the math on what it would cost to run lines out in the countryside, and they realized pretty quickly they couldn't make or that it would be too expensive to run those lines. So the federal government created the Rural Utility Service, and that was a partnership between the farmers in rural parts and residents in rural parts of the country. They provided them with low interest loans. The people then who started the cooperatives themselves, put some money in, and that's essentially where we come from today. You know, we were established to provide safe, reliable, and affordable electricity to areas of the country where there wasn't any electric service. All of us adopted the cooperative business model, which means we're not for profit. We provide electricity as close to cost as possible. We're owned by the people, the members we serve, and we are democratically governed.
Small D. Okay.
There are currently 44 distribution co-ops serving in Minnesota. Those are the local companies that deliver the electricity to the farms and homes in the rural parts of the state. Six generation and transmission cooperatives, which are owned by the distribution co-ops, currently serve in Minnesota, though two of them, Eleno and East River, are really transmission cooperatives, and they're actually members of Basin, which is another one of the four G&Ts. Again, we're locally operated. We have headquarters in over 50 cities in Minnesota. We're governed by a board of directors that is elected from the membership. That board sets policies, rates, and procedures, and then those policies are implemented by the cooperative's professional staff. We really are economic drivers in rural Minnesota. We employ over 5,000 people across the state, and these are generally considered very good jobs in those communities with good wages and good benefits. We serve just over 800,000 meters in Minnesota, or about 1.8 million Minnesotans get their electricity from co-ops. The median size co-op is just over 6,000, but we range in size from just under 2,000 to more than 130,000 members. We supply 14.5 billion kilowatt hours per year. That's about 18% of the state total, and generate about 1.4 billion in revenue. Again, you know, we operate at close to cost. We do have to maintain certain levels of margins for lenders. But any revenues that go above and beyond our operating costs in a given year are returned to members through what's called capital credits. And on average, the co-ops return about $26 million a year to their members in credits. We also invest quite a bit in the rural economic development of our communities. We have access to federal money through the Rural Utility Service, rural economic development loans and grants, and Minnesota has historically been one of the leading states to access those grants. In 2012, the last year we had numbers for them, cooperatives guaranteed over 2.4 million in no interest loans to businesses in the state. In terms of generation and transmission, for most of our existence, electric co-ops bought the generation from other types of utilities, either the investor owns or the municipals. The G&Ts were created first mainly as transmission cooperatives to get the energy out to the countryside, and then we added larger generation in the 50s, 60s, and 70s when the market for electricity, where the supply where the demand was approaching the supply. The vast majority of generation built by cooperatives prior to 2000 was coal. And one of the reasons for that is we did most of our building of generation in the 70s. And at the time, coal was really the only option for us. The federal government, if they were providing the loans to us, wouldn't allow us to build natural gas because of the supply of natural gas at the time was so tight. This was also the time of the Three Mile Island, so no nuclear plants were getting built either. And that really left us the option of building coal. And that's why so much of our portfolios were coal up until just a decade or two ago. As I mentioned, there are six generation and transmission co-ops that serve Minnesota. Great River Energy, which is by far the largest, has 28 member cooperatives or distribution co-ops, serves in Minnesota and a portion of northwestern Wisconsin. Their generation mix is coal, including combined heat and power, natural gas, hydropower, wind, refuse-derived fuel, and solar. Minn Kota has 11 members, 8 in Minnesota and 3 in North Dakota. They're also closely associated with the Northern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency. They have 2 coal plants, also a large wind and hydro portfolio. Like the munis, most of the co-ops in the western half of the state receive an allocation from the Western Area Power Administration, which includes the hydro from the Missouri River. Four G&Ts, Basin, which also has as members East River and LNO, they serve 137 members in 9 states. Probably have the most diverse fuel resource among the cooperatives, with coal, natural gas, both combined cycle and peaking plants, wind, hydro, oil, nuclear, and recovered fuels. Dareland serves 25 members in 4 states, has a mix of coal, hydro, natural gas, landfill gas, animal waste energy, wind, solar, and 2 of their coal plants currently, roughly about 15% of their portfolio, are in the process of shutting down. And they will be buying much of their, or a portion of that will be replaced by purchases through the MISO market. Generation is diversifying among all of the G&Ts. This is a fact of life. 2 decades ago, we produced about 90% of our electricity with coal. Now it ranges, depending on the G&T, from 59 to 78%. Some of the differences that we have with other utilities in the state. I mentioned before that we sell about 18% of the electricity in the state. However, we provide service to over 85% of the geographic area. And that means our distribution networks, the lines and poles that it takes to bring the electricity out to the countryside, we have much more investment in that. In fact, our 123,000 miles of electric distribution lines are more than the 3 IOUs combined. And that really does shape a lot of our different views on energy policy in Minnesota. We average about 6.1 customers per mile of distribution line, compared with 38 consumers per mile for the IOUs and 48 for the municipal utilities. And our revenue per mile of line is also significantly less than it is for other utilities. 79% of our co-op members have a per capita income below the state average, meaning that rate increases have a significant impact to their budgets. We also have significantly fewer commercial and industrial customers, and that makes, in particular, conservation is a much more difficult for us, because you really do get much better bang for the buck when you're applying conservation dollars to large industrial and commercial loads. It also means that our daily demand curve is much steeper than it is for other utilities. There's a slide here showing GRE's peak demand on July 21st. And what it shows is that, you know, for much of the day, you know, we're not selling a lot of electricity. Really what happens is that when people start arriving home from work, our peak goes up significantly. And as a result of this, we've had to be pretty creative over the years on developing systems, number one, to avoid having to build new generation, because that really is what drives electric costs. And two, we really were the first utilities to invest heavily in demand management, which shifts usage from one part of the day to another or reduces it during peak operating times. We also were early adapters in smart meters, in a large part because it was less expensive for us to invest in these meters than it was to pay someone to go out and read meters. And we also invested in them, too, because of our load management, which required us to be able to turn on and off various loads on the other side of the meter. So that's all I have. I can answer any questions. I'm looking forward to getting to know all of the new members and revisiting with all of the veteran members on the committee.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome, Mr. Johnson. You talked a little bit about load management. We kind of referred to it as off-peak. Can you give us just a real quick synopsis on how that works and how it's changed in the last few years? You know, for a lot of people in rural Minnesota, the off-peak electric rate was something that they really depended on to heat their homes. I had a conversation with one of our local farmers this weekend in the Ace Hardware store in Roseau. That's a shameless plug, by the way.
Yeah.
And he told me just a few years ago on their farmstead they were paying to heat with electricity and run all of their lights and everything about $400 a month. And now it's pushing $1,000, and they're getting fewer and fewer off-peak hours that they can use to offset the cost of heating. Can you help me out a little bit?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, one of the more popular, particularly in your area of the state, where we actually there are quite a bit of homes that heat with electricity, or they use a dual fuel option, which they'll have a propane furnace, but also have an electric plenum heater attached to it. And what historically the co-ops have done is when someone will sign up for a controlled heating, Minn Kota, which serves your area of the state, is a winter peaking system, which means their highest usage occurs typically on about 9 o'clock at night in January or February on really cold nights. And so what they'll do then is they will have when they approach those peaks, they will have the propane kick in. Now, last winter was the perfect storm in a lot of ways for what you were just talking about, energy, particularly heating costs going up. There was a shortage of propane, but there was also, on the coldest nights of the year, there was a shortage actually in the market, and Minn Kota was actually having to buy quite a bit of energy on the MISO market, in part because on those cold nights we've also found that the wind turbines don't blow, and Minn Kota actually has 30% of its portfolio in wind. And so on those really cold nights last year, they weren't getting any performance out of 30% of their energy portfolio, and they were having to buy on very high prices on the market.
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chair. And just for members' information, you know, in rural Minnesota, well, Rural Electric's members do not have natural gas. I mean, that's just not available in the rural areas. So hopefully we can keep an eye on the prices that people are paying on their homes and farmsteads to heat. And thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. And again, just like with Mr. Black, this will not be the last time we see you before this committee, and we'll definitely look forward to staying in touch with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we've got the IOUs. Mr. Evans. I guess all three of you guys going to come down at the same time? Sounds good. Welcome to the committee, and please state your names for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, my name is Lauren Lautug. I am with Otter Tail Power Company in Fergus Falls, Minnesota. I will give a general overview of the investor-owned utilities. You've got something in your packet that looks like this. It says Minnesota Investor-Owned Utilities. I will conclude with a very brief discussion of a one-page handout, and then I'll hand it off here to my colleagues from Minnesota Power and Xcel, Mr. Underdahl, Mr. Evans, to speak for their companies. So the Minnesota utilities, as you've heard already, there are cooperatives, and there are municipals, and there are investor-owned utilities. We are the investor-owned utilities. We are the investor-owned electric utilities, our investor-owned gas utilities in the state of Minnesota as well. We are distinguished by several features. First, how we are governed, and we invite you to take notes and ask questions after we're done. We, our companies are all governed by boards of directors that are elected by the shareholders. We are unique because we are capitalized both by debt equity and by equity that comes from shareholders. And just so you know, we're about 50% equity and 50% debt. That's generally true of investor-owned utilities nationwide. And finally, our electric rates are governed by the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission, which we'll speak more of in a minute. Regulatory background for investor-owned utilities. Prior to about 1975, our electric rates were basically governed utility or by community, and so we would negotiate with the communities what would be fair and just rates in those communities. The Minnesota legislature at some point just prior to 1975 decided, let's put the electric utilities, investor-owned utilities, under the governance of the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. The Minnesota PUC had been in action since the 1870s. They governed railroad rates back in the early days. And in 1975, they decided, the legislature decided it would be good if the electric investor-owned and the natural gas utilities were governed for rate purposes by the MPUC. We, at the same time, divided the state into service territories, we call them. The state drew hard boundaries. Where does each electric utility serve, whether it's an investor-owned or it's a co-op or it's a muni? Munis basically serve the municipal boundaries of cities. So hard boundaries were drawn, and so since that time we have had regulated monopolies inside those boundaries, the investor-owns have. And our rates have been governed by the PUC, as I mentioned. Purposes of public utility regulation are several. First, to provide universal access to essential energy services. We are obligated to serve customers inside of our territorial boundaries. There's no customer we can say, no, we don't want to serve you, even though there may be from time to time a customer we may not want to serve. So we also have to provide to them non-discriminatory rates, which means that just because someone's from a small city versus a large city, we charge like customers in the same customer class the same rates. There's public review of our utility costs and expenditures during rate cases. There's integrated state energy goals and planning. We avoid the costly duplication of services through service territories. And finally, we have strong safety and reliability standards that are also overseen by the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission and the Department of Commerce. Our presence in the state, the investor-owned utilities, have a significant presence in Minnesota. And of the 2.1 million households in the state of Minnesota, we as a group, and including the gas investor-owned utilities, we serve about 1.5 million of the 2.1 million households in Minnesota, and over 670,000 businesses in the state of Minnesota. In terms of being employers, we are about the 17th largest employer in the state of Minnesota. Minnesota investor-owned utilities have more than 9,000 employees. Minnesota jobs, we provide competitive wages and benefits for union and non-union employees. Of our 9,300 employees, about 5,000 are union employees. And so more than half are union employees and primarily members of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. We have more than $750 million in employee wages annually, and indirectly, we create 24,000 supplier chain jobs. In terms of history, we've been around for a long time. Xcel has its roots back to 1881, Minnesota Power to 1906, and Otter Tail Power, my company, is relatively new. We were founded as recently as 1909. So I think that's 106 years present. I'm going to bypass the questions for now, and we'll let Minnesota Power and Excel speak. As soon as I just mentioned that there is in your handout a flyer on Otter Tail, it says On for Minnesota. And I'll just draw attention to the map that's there. Otter Tail Power serves in the states of Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. And we have about half our customers in Minnesota and half in South and North Dakota. We are by far the smallest electric utility in the state of Minnesota. And there's information on the right side of your page with regard to wages and jobs and our electric rates. I will point out one thing. Mr. Black mentioned that the typical sized municipal utility in Minnesota is, I think he said, 2,300 or 2,500. Otter Tail has, we serve 153 cities in the state of Minnesota, and I've had a slide in this committee in prior years. Our median, if you stack 153 cities from the largest to the smallest, the median-sized city is Winger, Minnesota. Winger, Minnesota has 220 people, and it has a median population, a median income, household income of $31,000. So is there a solar mandate in Winger, Minnesota? Yes, the citizens of Winger will pay for a solar mandate. But as Mr. Black pointed out, if you're from Rochester, that's entirely up to the Public Utility Board and the City of Rochester to decide if they might choose solar or not choose solar. So Winger has a mandate, Rochester does not. So with that, I'll just call your attention to the back page. The information that's there shows Otter Tail's performance relative to the environment. I think the graphs that you see here would generally be true of all of the investor-owned electrics. Our emissions of sulfur dioxide, nitrous oxide, and mercury continue to trend down. These graphs go from 1985 and forecast out to 2020. And our CO2 trend is based on CO2 emissions per megawatt hour. And you can see Otter Tail's is flat and projected to decline based on the addition of more wind power and having fewer coal plants. So with that, I will pass this along to Mr. Underdahl from Minnesota Power, Mr. Evans from Xcel Energy.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Thor Underdahl, and committee members. Thor Underdahl from Minnesota Power. Minnesota Power is a vertically integrated investor-owned utility. We generate, transmit, and distribute energy to a 26,000 square mile radius in northeastern Minnesota. Our customer mix consists of 144,000 residential customers. We service 16 municipalities and also provide electricity to one Wisconsin utility, Superior Water, Light and Power, which is an affiliate of our parent company, Elite. We're very unique, not only in Minnesota, but across the nation, because we also service some of the largest industrial customers in the United States. Over half of our electricity sales actually come from our large industrial customers, so that's an incredibly unique mix for a utility. That also means that we need to provide reliable and affordable energy 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365. Our loads don't peak quite the same way that Excel or Otter Tail or other IOUs do. I also have a handout in here with Minnesota Power on top, and I'll just have you note on the back, one of the big initiatives at Minnesota Power that we've rolled out is our Energy Forward strategy, and this really aligns well with what Minnesota is doing in general towards moving to a larger generation mix. So we currently are at about 80% coal and 20% renewables, coming from 95% coal and 5% renewables in 2005, so quite an improvement in 10 years. And we are moving towards a mixture of one-third renewables, one-third coal, and one-third natural gas in the late 2020 timeframe, and doing so in, again, a way that looks towards reliability, affordability, and safety for all of our customers in northeastern Minnesota. So with that, if you have any questions after Mr. Evans goes, I'd be happy to answer them. Thanks.
Mr. Evans.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rick Evans. I'm with Xcel Energy Government Affairs. There's a sheet in your packet, I think, that looks like this, that deals with Xcel Energy. I won't go over the numbers that are on here, though I'd be happy to answer questions. I should note, however, that the map in the middle of the page is a little bit of a could be a little bit misleading. Our service territory doesn't comprise big blocks of territory the way this shows. The service territory sort of snakes through this dark blue area
to the large population centers, and so much of that area is served by co-ops or municipal utilities within that area. But on a small map, that's the way the map drawers draw it. If you ever get a chance to see, Great River Energy has actually the best service territory map that I've ever seen. It's about 5x3x5, and I know there's a few around here somewhere. If you want to go look at those, that'll give you a real good in-depth picture of what the service territories that Lauren referred to look like. So let me just tell you a little bit about Xcel Energy. A lot of us, when we were kids, if you grew up in this area, remember NSP Minnesota was your power company. NSP Minnesota still exists. It is still the operating company that operates the utility here in the state of Minnesota. Xcel Energy is a holding company that owns a number of operating companies, and we operate under the trade name of Xcel Energy, but there is still an NSP Minnesota. NSP Minnesota is the largest utility in the state of Minnesota. It is also the largest utility in South Dakota and the largest utility in North Dakota, each of those states making up somewhere between 5% and 7% of our total customer base. So they're a small part of our business, but we're a big part of those two states with their smaller population. Contrary to what a lot of people believe, our headquarters is located in Minneapolis, Minnesota. It was when it was NSP Minnesota, and Xcel Energy, the holding company, still has its headquarters in Minneapolis, Minnesota, at 414 Nicollet Mall. We're building a brand new building right across the street. I don't remember what the address will be, probably 415 Nicollet Mall, and those two buildings together will comprise the national headquarters of Xcel Energy and the local headquarters of NSP Minnesota. Some other unique things about NSP or Xcel Energy, we are the only nuclear utility in the state. You may notice on the front of this, they talk about there's a graphic of our energy mix and how more than half of our energy comes from carbon-free source. That is largely, we can achieve that largely because we have the nuclear plants. Nuclear plants do not emit carbon dioxide, unlike the coal plants and the natural gas plants, and so that puts us in that position with respect to carbon. We have three nuclear reactors, two at Prairie Island and one up at Monticello. Particularly for those of you that are new on the committee, if you'd like to go take a tour of the nuclear plant, we can take legislators on tours. They are restricted access facilities, but policymakers come within the restrictions. So if any of you are ever interested in going and touring the nuclear plants, seeing how they operate, you're absolutely welcome to do that, and I would encourage you to let me know if you're interested, and if we can get a group of two or three, that sometimes makes it easier and more fun, and we will get those tours set up. One other thing I would say about Xcel Energy, I think it's highlighted on the front that we are the number one wind utility in the United States. Xcel Energy has had a wind mandate in the state of Minnesota since 1994. So due to some nuclear issues back in those days, we were the first company to get a wind or a renewable energy mandate. And we continue to have the higher renewable energy mandate, largely because we sort of got a head start. And so we're on a track to provide 30% of our energy from renewable sources by 2020. And then, of course, solar is the new thing, and we've been working on solar energy development for the last 2 years since the solar energy bill passed in the Minnesota legislature. All of these things are changing dramatically the way the energy business is operated in Minnesota. It's not like the good old days when you had a great big power plant somewhere with big transmission lines and then smaller distribution lines. We owned them all. We delivered energy over all of them. We were the, you know, really exclusively vertically integrated company. That's all changing, and we hope to be having that conversation with members of the committee over the next couple of years and into the future as we work with our policymakers to see how public policy can work with the changing utility environment that we work in. So with that, I will conclude my remarks and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions from any members of the committee? Well, I expect that each of our three testifiers will be people that we may be seeing around this committee this year, so thank you for providing the overview. The last item on our agenda is that Ms. Hendricks is going to provide us, in your package should be a handout. I'll let her explain it. Ms. Hendricks.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, once again, my name is Harriet Hendricks. I'm with House Fiscal Staff. I prepared two documents for you. One is this one. It won't have my notes on it, but It's an overview, high-level overview of general fund appropriations, and then another document, overview of significant changes, or I might say differences in general fund appropriations between the last two biennia. So I'm not going to point out every single item on these documents, since we have about 10 minutes. But what I will do is just kind of point out what to look for, what I put on here, what might not be on here but that you might be interested in if you have any questions. So starting off with the kind of, the table with the all the departments or agencies on the left-hand side, those are the ones that are within the purview of this committee. I should note that Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals is not on there, but it should be on there. But it doesn't receive any general fund appropriations. But that is actually another state agency or state entity in the within this committee. So these are only general fund appropriations that are on here. So not any appropriations from non-general funds. Just to give you kind of a sense of how much is general fund appropriations typically in this committee versus non-general fund in 12-13, just for the budget bill, it was about 70% of the budget came from the general fund. And in session 2013, so the budget bill, that budget bill, about 80% came from the general fund. So there's about 20-30% of the budget that typically comes from non-general fund funds. So on this first sheet, there's five boxes. The first one has the appropriations for fiscal year 12-13 that come from the budget bills in from the 2011 session. They're the appropriations, so not necessarily what is actually spent by the agency. So the appropriations made by the legislature. Spending tracks appropriations fairly closely because most are direct appropriations. So when you see here under type, it says direct or open. Most appropriations within this committee are direct, meaning that they are made typically for a limited period of time, usually within a biennium. Whereas open appropriations are those that we actually just talked about with the DMC, where there's authority for the agency to spend an unspecified amount of resources to meet a program's objectives. Then with estimates and forecasts provided by the agencies, then these appropriations or this money is appropriated to the agency. So all the way out, for instance, under DMC, you see for forecasted 16-17, you see that number appear that came from the fiscal note. So if that were to change these estimates, then we would change these numbers here. But direct appropriations would only be, changed when the legislature changes them. So the first one is for from 2011 session. The smaller box next to it and the more narrow one includes the flood disaster relief for Northeast Minnesota. Only appropriations in that bill were made to deed and housing. So those numbers are higher for those agencies. The rest of it all stays the same. The next one is for the appropriations that were made in the last budget year, 2013, for 14 and 15 appropriations. And again, I think you can look at the numbers and see them. If you have specific questions, let me know. And then that narrow box next to that, the fourth one, indicates the totals enacted in 13 and 14, so with the supplemental budget bill. There was no supplemental budget bill in 2012, so that's just not on there because it wasn't there. And then the last box indicates the forecasted amount, so those appropriations that are ongoing, the legislature were just to reenact law as it currently stands, these would be the appropriations to all of these agencies from the general fund. Any questions on that particular overview?
Any questions? All right, continue. Okay.
So then the next document provides an overview of kind of the most significant changes or differences between the two biennia. Clearly from the first overview, you can see that the numbers for 14-15 are much higher than for 12-13. So just to kind of give the members of this committee an indication of where that comes from, what the sources of those differences are. I made an overview where, first of all the way at the top, you see that the total difference, and that includes all appropriations direct and as well as open, as well as ongoing and one-time, combined an increase of a little over $145 million. That is about a 53% increase. And so that increase comes mainly from the Department of Employment and Economic Development, Department of Commerce, MHFA, Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, and then Explorer Minnesota Tourism. So that's the kind of the summary at the top, and then I split that out by department, by these four departments where the changes are. The first one, Department of Employment and Economic Development. Of course, a big one-time appropriation, for instance, for fiscal year 12 and 13, was to the Minnesota Investment Fund, $15 million for the flood relief in northeast Minnesota, but also a $3 million one-time appropriation in fiscal year 2012 for the Minnesota Investment Fund, and then the redevelopment account. Big one-time appropriations in 14-15 were for a broadband development, redevelopment grant program at the Initiative Foundation, six in total, and the Distressed City Economic Initiative Program. So that totals that for one-time appropriations, a little over $30 million to DEED. I would kind of draw your attention more to kind of the ongoing appropriation changes, because those carry over into 16 and 17, or that there's tails, as we call it.
Thank you, Ms. Yeah. And just to be clear, I really like the format that you've laid this out in terms of just not listing a number, but of providing some context for members, listing one-time appropriations in 12 and 13, the one-time appropriations of 14 and 15, and then the ongoing items that are built into the base for fiscal years. Actually, there'll be ongoing appropriations for 14 and 15. Okay, and so she's done that by each of these areas. And I just want to say thanks. And I would recommend that members save this item in their save folder. I think this is a document that we'll be referencing going forward. But rather than having you read this for members, you provided a very thorough analysis, and I just wanted to say thank you. It's a very good summary of data. So at this point, we'll just go to questions from members of the committee. And seeing none with that, that'll wrap up our agenda for the day. Stay tuned. We'll see everybody on Wednesday. This committee is adjourned.